Good morning, everybody. It is 7 o'clock. It is a Thursday. That can only mean one thing. It means it's time for the Burning Platform with me and my co-host, Pumi Mashiho, who is in the studio. She is ready to go. We've got an excellent guest coming up in a short while. It's time for new heroes, says her shirt, while mine says, we the people. We the people in Venda. Yeah, so between us, we're full of political slogans this morning, which is excellent.
But, you know, every time we start the show, I really miss the normal bullshit little clip. Because this like, I don't know where Jack found this music, but it's too, like, it doesn't rile you up, you know? It kind of...
Oh, you want no more bullshit? I will bring that clip for Jack, and he can start the show with that on a Thursday. I'm happy to make that a Burning Platform thing.
Yeah, it can be just...
All right. No worries. No more bullshit. Here it comes.
We need a morning pick-me-up. Thursday.
Well, I've decided, and while we're waiting for our guest, who I think you're going to enjoy hearing from, he's none other than the well-respected and admired and never afraid Thebe Kalafeng, who I've known for, geez, Bumi, I've known him for like 25 years probably. And I see him every now and then, not nearly as much as I used to, because Thebe used to be quite the man around town.
The man around Africa.
I know. He's outgrown us, you see. But he has lots to say about how our puzzle piece fits into the whole picture in the world. And we're going to talk to him about that in a short while. You know, it's important sometimes to get an objective opinion on how we're doing as Brand South Africa, and not just Brand South Africa, but how our continent is doing internationally. So it'll be interesting to hear his thoughts on that. And we'll take a slight diversion from speaking to politicians and political analysts and that kind of thing this week, which I'm excited about.
Also, because I completely enjoyed last week's show. And I think that where we are as well, part of the job of the Burning Platform is also to locate us all in the world, and, you know, outside of just listening to the mass voices of what's happening in the GNU, because there's so much more to what politics also means, and what policies and decisions and all of those kinds of things mean to us, and what they mean to the citizens. And but yeah, super excited. No, you're
so I did a little housekeeping yesterday. I was going through my ex Twitter account, which I've really paid very scant attention to over the past couple of years. So that's my fault. And I've decided to go and tidy it up, because it is kind of important who you follow and who follows you. And, you know, you have to manage that. And people use the word curate way too often because they all think they're museum directors. But it is important to know what's going on in the world. And since X is most of us, it's our main source of headline news. I wouldn't say in-depth understanding. So I went through it yesterday.
Person has like a 30 tweet thread. It's never going to be in-depth.
Well, I saw one of those yesterday, which I thought was fascinating. An investigative journalist went and basically trawled a woman who writes for, I think, The Atlantic, and did like a 30-part thread on all the headlines this woman has written, and she's nothing short of a chocolate fireplace. I mean, the fact that this person is allowed to be a journalist in any self-respecting country by any group of people who call themselves an audience for this stuff is beyond me. In fact, I don't think anyone reads it. It's just like, it's pure propaganda and nonsense. Anyway, I digress. I went through my ex and I added all the people who I have blocked or unfollowed. not like the nobodies, but I added all of them back because I realized my Overton. I just want to quickly finish this idea.
Yeah.
My Overton window shrank and I needed to expand it again. So I am now following a bunch of people who I vehemently disagree with and who've irritated me sufficient for me to have blocked or unfollowed them in the past. And I think it's probably going to be a very bumpy ride in the beginning, but I'm looking forward to it. So that's my news.
It's going to be great. So while Jack is setting, I wanted to say young Tebe, but he's out here looking so suave and sophisticated and regal and with a salt and pepper beard. It's crazy. But ooh. I do have to say, somebody just put on the comments that they tagged you. There's this new X page called Josie versus Josie that I have literally become obsessed with over the past couple of weeks. Because it has these like 10-year pictures that's just showing how Josie has fallen apart over the years. But I also see a couple of things that I think we're missing out on. And one of the things that I have seen consistently is how many businesses have shut down in Joburg in this period of time. Because you will see they'll post a picture of a business downtown in Germiston or whatever, and it was a factory. And then 10 years later, it's an abandoned building that's been taken over by hijackers. Or a fish and chip shop at the corner, and 10 years later, it's all boarded up. And that, for me, is also part of the story of what's happened in the falling out, you know, of Joburg, is our economy has contracted so much and so many businesses. So when you talk about unemployment and what it looks like, what that page also shows very starkly is what that looks like. All those businesses that are boarded up and shut down and haven't moved somewhere else. They haven't left Joburg. They're gone. They're just out of the economy. So anyway, one of the things. And now,
depressing.
Ta-da!
Diddy.
Look at this man. So, first of all, Mystique Alafeng, I saw you not that long ago, and we had a very brief interaction. It was at a podcast thing that DJ Spood set up, and we said, we must get together, we must go for a coffee, and it's just never happened. And that's totally my fault. I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm so happy to have you on the show.
We're here for an even better reason. So, I mean, we could have met then and talked about the world, talk about dilapidated buildings, talk about contracting economies. But here we're talking about expanding our identities, expanding excellence, and expanding Africanness.
Well, let me give you a proper introduction. You deserve it. The incredible Tebe Kalafeng, an award-winning Pan-African marketer, a non-executive director on private and public sector boards, many of them, and he's worked on over 100 brands across South Africa. He really is a force of nature. We're very pleased to have him here with us today. He has written that very book. Hold it up again so that people can see it. There it is. It's called The Traveler. And I like, is that a red beret or is it just a red fez? Or is it, what's going on?
No, man, this fez is from Burkina Faso.
Haribo.
Yeah. This has got nothing to do with your best friends.
You know, some people will miss it. You're a branding man. You know, some people will look at that and go,
But let me tell you, we had different hats. So I had my first hat that I wanted to have here was one that is, it was a leopard hat, spotted hat.
Wow.
And they said to me, "You look like a dictator." I said, "Yes." I said, "I'm very aware that it's that." Then I had another one. I had a, I was going into the distance in Sudan, walking. So you don't see my face. You just see this incredible figure in the desert. They said, "We can't see your face." I'm like, "I'm not winning here." So I then hold like a proper African dictator. I hold pictures of myself of three, four years ago. Cause you know, even you in your profiles, you don't show pictures of yourself the last 10 years. you have to pick the one where you were absolutely at the peak of your amazingness. So I went and picked exactly the same thing. I said, "Let me get a picture that works. This one works, right, Karen?" That's how we adapted this picture. I don't even think then EFF was such a great brand now. So if that's what people are going to think it is.
Well, you've done the most beautiful introduction for me here, because people do wear different hats and you've worn many different hats in your career. And just to carry on the symbolism, I mean, hats have been the identifier. Do you remember the old regime? They used to wear those trilbies, you know, the old ministers.
Yes. All of them used to wear their blackjack suits.
That's right. And Salva Kiir, you mentioned Sudan, but South Sudan, he wears a Stetson hat, famously. We had Mobutu Sese Seko with his leopard print sort of beret. Well, also kind of a fez, but a small hat on top without a rim.
You have Amilcar Cabral with these black and white knitted hat. Mm. And because, as you said, you know, hats actually tell a different story. So Amilcar Cabral, that hat, he got it from the peasants. He got it from a peasants in Cabo Verde because he fought for the liberation of Cabo Verde and Guinea-Bissau. And in Guinea-Bissau, he met some peasants and they said to him, "You have done so much for us, fighting for our rights. We can't give you anything. Can we just give you this? It's the least we can do." And he took that, and that became his symbol.
Wow.
Hats.
So what hats are you wearing at the moment? And tell us why you decided to write this book.
So this is a Ndebele hat. This is a Ndebele crown. So you know, last night. So it's a pity last night you couldn't make it. Everybody says, including the publishers, including the exclusive books, they say in the history of book launches, they have never seen such an epic event because it was everything that you would have expect about. Like somebody said to me, they said, it is everything we'd expect about you. It was Pan-African. There were drums. There was Impiwe Dana singing. There was an African poet. There was two facilitators instead of one facilitator. The MC was from Lesotho. The closing was from Kenya. It was packed to the rim. It was over 500, probably 600 people.
Wow.
in the courtyard at Rosebank. There were drums everywhere, and it is just the most. I've never seen anything like that. And I've been to, you know, girls, we've been to many events. I've been to book launches. They say they have never seen an event like that. And all of them, when they say we wanted to talk, we wanted to come celebrate the story. We wanted to come celebrate the story of a young man who comes from Kimberley, travels all the way to Johannesburg. From Johannesburg, first stop out of Johannesburg is Belgium, New York, Ohio, back to Africa, 94. And from 94 to 2024 has been to every single country in the continent, every island surrounds the continent, every continent in the world, bungee jumps, skydive, climb mountains. And they said, that story is our story. They said that story, and they said, that's why we're here today. And yesterday you could see all that.
You know, I mean, that story of just the journey all over. And I think one of the things that as South Africans we're grappling with is our Africanness.
Indeed.
Is our Africanness.
Because we're South Africans and the rest of them are Africans. You know how we speak.
And so on the journey and seeing and meeting all of these people, what does the continent looking down on us, not quite physically down, not looking metaphorically down on us, what do they see of who we are?
Well, they see a couple of things, and it's in phases. So from 1994, you could say perhaps to 2004, they saw the New York of Africa, the America of Africa. They saw a place of opportunity. They saw a place which, quote-unquote, owed them something. Because during the apartheid struggle, whether it is Zimbabwe, whether it is Zambia hosting us, whether it is Tanzania, whether it is the Nigerians buying us arms,
Burkina Faso sending us four AK-47s.
So there was a sense of you owe us, but not only do you owe us, this is also our victory, and this is a place of opportunity. So you have that. So then you have the middle part. The middle part is where now the quote unquote the xenophobic part of incidents of xenophobia, incidents of a lack of opportunities that people expected, South Africans expected themselves, but you still have the influx of non-South Africans into Africa, non-Africans into South Africa, who seem to find opportunities, you know, whether it's creating a township, with a township tuck shop, or whether it is making lots of babies in a township. But you know, so they seem to be thriving, and then the South Africans seem to be despairing. And then when the xenophobic attacks and all those and the riots and all those things, they now look at place that is, they look at us as ungrateful because we now say, get out of our country, Maba Abahambe. They're looking at all those type of phrases that we use. And they say that this is an ungrateful continent, a country. They don't remember, they don't recognize us. Then you've got another way as well. The other part as well, the third part I'll say is, they also still look at us as an, another inspiration. So the first part was an economic inspiration. The middle part was an economic desperation. This part here is a creative inspiration. This is the country that created the Amapianos. This is a country that gave them the first Black Miss Universe. This is a country that is constantly creating the Esther Matlangos and all those. So they look at us as, they've looked at us in those phases, if you will. Inspiration, desperation, and perspiration, if you will. Perhaps in terms of, that's a place where creative perspiration.
Sure. That's quite a fascinating way of breaking it down too, right? Because I think we have seen, particularly in the political discourse, a rearing back of that ugly head, whether it is, and all the news that we're seeing right now, we were just talking about that page, Josie versus Josie, right? Mm. And almost constantly, some of the vitriol that we see is vitriol that says, we South Africans would never do this to our country. It's all of these people that come here to do this.
I know. It's that because with the us versus them is at its height now, because the desperation I talk about is on both sides. The desperate South African and the desperate non-South African who's trying to make a living here, came here for the economic opportunity, and the South African who is not getting what they thought their government, their country will deliver post-apartheid. So yeah, it's us versus them.
Talk to us a little bit about the AU.
The AU is funded over 70% by Western and Asian partners, was built by the Chinese. So I don't know what else you would have expected. So that must give you an idea then. I am not going to build your house, and I'm not going to fund your expenses. And then your agenda must be your own. That's my agenda. Yeah. I'm going to run there.
Spot on.
And what that has translated as on the rest of the continent. We see what it's translated as here in South Africa, and we'll talk a little bit just now about BRICS. But how has that translated then into how the rest of the continent is evolving, if at all?
I think it may be a horrible thing, and I'm sure they will not invite me back to the AU, but I think it is seen as just another building, another institution, rather than the mother of all buildings and the mother of all institutions. Because if you look at 63, when 25 May, when it was inaugurated, when Kwame Nkrumah, Haile Selassie and the 32 presidents who got together to tell that story and to inaugurate the first AU building. OAU. They had Organized African Unity. They had a vision. They had a vision for, and that vision is beautiful. I outlined it yesterday somewhere else, that it's a vision of a one passport for Africans, a one currency for Africans, a common defense system, and open borders. So if we had just done that, we can imagine where we would be as a continent. We'll be more united, we'll be more independent, if you will, we'll be more secure. Because right now what happens? Well, if there's a fight, the AU looks at the UN, please help us. That's why you got so many UN building, UN helicopters all over the continent. If there's a health issue like the COVID, we go back to WHO. Please help us with your vaccines. So the AU, unfortunately, hasn't lived up to its vision, hasn't lived up to its potential. You know, but its vision is about a united, integrated, and prosperous. Prosperous, integrated, and peaceful Africa. That's Vision 2063. But that's the same vision it was in 63.
I don't know. I don't know, because this has been attempted. This has been attempted in the EU, and it's not doing well. Like, it's not it's not looking strong and robust, and there are countries constantly threatening either to leave or to go back to their own currencies. And I don't know that it wouldn't just be an AU writ large through which foreign powers can dictate, as you precisely put it earlier with the AU, what the agenda must be. I'm not so sure that we would be able to find enough common ground. I mean, we can't even, there's this huge rift, and let's just be honest about these things before we start looking at the silver linings and the optimism, because I know that's where you and I both like to head, Tebe and Pumi. There's Francophone Africa, there's Anglophone Africa, there's a big division there. The two don't particularly have common ground on many things, not least of which foreign policy. We've got unstable governments, and we've
Christian.
Got Christian Muslim. We've got unstable governments who are increasingly isolated, which is a good thing, from the more democratically elected governments. We have people who are like, you know, the Moroccans are just, they're just thundering ahead regardless, and they're making enemies every step of the way, but it doesn't seem to have too much effect. We've got countries that are extremely fragile.
Delegate business delegation last week.
But I mean, I was in Morocco last 2 weeks ago. I was in Morocco 2 weeks ago, and it is. I think
with part of the delegation.
No. I wasn't. I was
okay.
I was independent. I've been going to Morocco for 7 years in a row, and if there's anything I've learned about them, first, there's a strong culture, which is beautiful to see. There's an growing independence from colonial pasts. You know, they are no longer as infatuated with the France of the world as the other Francophone countries are. They're asserting themselves as an African, and then as an independent country. Then there is a pivot towards continent. There's a continental pivot that I'm seeing that is beautiful to watch. So that's my experience of Morocco, and they're investing a lot now into the continent. So all the challenges that we hear, whether it's territorial challenges and all those, of course, one wishes that they could be resolved sooner. But as far as my experience with the country, and I try to stay away from the politics of the country to rather look at the potential of the country, and to me, it's been one country that I love going back to. Well, I love going back to every country, but I've been to that one.
We can't pretend there isn't that problem with the Western Sahara, with the Zarahawi.
That's what I'm saying. That I wish some of these territorial challenges can be resolved sooner, so that we can just get on with the big project called Africa, the big project. And I think you said something, Gareth, I want to say as well. So the African Union were the first people to pioneer a continental a union.
Mm.
We just, as typical Africans, delay, because the Europeans then caught on to the idea of creating an EU. That came after we pioneered the idea. We piloted the idea of having
you're leaving out the United States of America, which was kind of a continental.
Well, that's not a union. That's a collection of Trump crazies. But we love them because they educated us.
It's in the name, United States of America. It's in the name, so I don't know that that's necessarily important.
But it's not 50. Is it 52? I can't remember. It's not 50. No, I'm
52.
In the US.
Okay,
It's not 52 countries. It is 52 independent, interdependent states. Maybe that's how you look at it. Whereas the AU is supposed to be 54, 55, or 60 independent states. But I think we need to, what we can learn anything to your point, if you can learn anything from the US, is how to be interdependent. Because I think if, as Africans, we're interdependent, we would have resolved the issues of open borders long time ago. And the challenges that we've had about North and South, Francophone, Anglophone, Christian and Muslim and all others, I think those would have been resolved better if we had resolved the interdependence of Africa.
And then what of the, out there in Midrand, African Parliament?
Oh, that one as well.
No, because, you know, I think that there are so many.
What do they do there?
What do they do there?
They took away Gallagher Estate from us, which we used to use.
I just don't know what they do, unfortunately. I don't know what my friend, one of the presidents, is to head it up. But I don't know what they do at the African Parliament, actually.
I don't think they do either.
And it's not. And South Africa funds it. So South Africa funds the African Parliament in Midrand. But I've never heard anything that they have done for the continent that I could point to and say, now here is a continental stand run by that comes out of the AU, the African Parliament, or all those. I think Thabo Mbeki is probably one of the people I admire more than anybody else post-independence, because I think at least he tried something. He tried to put an agenda on the table that will fast-track the interdependence and the independence of the continent. So interdependence internally and the dependent and the independence from thing, and the one who tried to create the sense of an African identity with his African Renaissance message, we just failed to create more Mbekis even among the young ones, and we stuck with somebody's idea that unfortunately he probably doesn't have the institutional platform as or institutional power rather to be able to see through like he did when he was president.
I mean, you need a driver to make these things happen. And Obasanjo and Mbeki proved that when they formed the AU out of the OAU, but it was really just a renaming process because
in Durban, yes.
Nothing much more has been achieved. I just want to finish the thought. We do have an alliance. It may not be continental because I don't think we will find enough common ground just because we live on the same piece of land. You know, that's conjoined. I think our best chance of this is probably BRICS. And I know that's going to upset a lot of people, but, you know, BRICS nations account for 28% of the global economy. Not insignificant. The membership is much smaller than if you were to try and cobble together an alliance between all African nations. And in fact, it's in the news because just this week, all of those presidents and prime ministers got together with Vladimir Putin in Russia. And they discussed the plan for BRICS going forward.
Welcome new members.
Yeah, and if there's ever been a chance for South Africa to be part of a club that might actually get things done, I mean, we've got a strong man in the form of Vladimir Putin who's trying with his might and his strength of will to weld this union together. If we ever had a chance, it would be this, not this soft, let's all get together and kumbaya and put aside our differences while people are hacking each other's heads off because of religious differences along the east coast of this continent. This is a much better chance of getting things together, even if people don't like Putin and they don't, you know, and there are people who don't like Xi and they, you know, they have a problem with this and democracy is not democracy and this ice ain't democracy and all that stuff. But here, I mean, Cyril went there and I heard, I want to get this off my chest too.
Get it off your chest, baby, please, while I have coffee.
Like the DA released some statement this week about how they disagree with Cyril. Let me tell you, so you guys chose to be in the GNU. Now, I know how the rules
work. I could never understand them. They missed the U part of the G.
Right. Just like we were talking about the United Nations earlier. So there's a government of national unity. Again, this word is coming up a lot this morning. Now, and the president has sole discretion when it comes to our foreign affairs policy. He doesn't have to consult with anybody. That's not part of what happens. It's like Alan Windey going to New York, my least favorite member of the DA, and spending a whole lot of taxpayers' money and effort to try and figure out how we can be more environmentally responsible and use renewable energies and all this stuff, which is purely political.
Instead of cleaning up Cape Town, creating a better housing, reducing inequality and all those.
And mining coal and how about fracking oil? And we've got huge reserves of oil off the west coast of South Africa, which we could use to build a sovereign wealth fund. But no, he wants to go and put up fucking solar panels everywhere. And John Steenhuisen now saying, oh, well, I don't know if I agree with you about this Vladimir Putin. Nobody asked you. You're the Minister of Agriculture. Sort that out.
Is working on his first degree.
Doesn't matter. I don't care about qualifications. If we cared about qualifications, we would never have had President Zuma, who's basically illiterate.
I'm being facetious because part of the problem in this government of GNU and the brand called South Africa is you had an opposition party which ostensibly stood for exceptionalism and excellence and all those people qualifying for what they of competency and qualification. Meritocracy is the word I was looking for. Thank you so much. English is good. As soon as they came into power, they forgot all the things that they said they stood for. Now it's no longer about meritocracy and qualifications. Now you put a couple of times with matric, and now all of a sudden, you used to say Zuma's got standard two, and he can't. No, shouldn't be in the country. Are you with me? I'm just saying FYI. I don't understand.
I don't care about what people say, because all politicians have lied to me my whole life long, and I'm not going to believe one of them.
It's not South African politicians, it's just how politics are. The UK, you'll understand that politics is a different product and people are a different product.
I think it attracts a kind of pathological person, and I think politicians themselves are terrible. No, I do. I think they're terrible people. But here's my point. If we're going to talk about merit, we can judge ministers within the first 100 days on their performance. And it would appear to me, and this is to the chagrin of the ministers in the ANC, that our best ministers come from the DA and the PA, without a doubt. Their results are there for all to see. Home Affairs is an absolute resounding success. That guy, whatever his name is, Schreiber, I'd never heard of him before this government of national unity. He has cleared the backlog, and he's got Home Affairs working like it never worked for 30 years. That is admirable and laudable.
I think when Nkosi Sana was there, she had some interesting reforms in thingy. So I think we should acknowledge that as well. But I think the other thing we should acknowledge is that the PA with Gayton McKenzie and the DA, I don't know who's running it.
Helen.
It depends whether it's Helen from the kitchen or the bedroom, or whether it is Steenhuisen from the podium. I don't understand who's running the party. But what they do well is public relations. They know how to communicate any measure of success, whether it is just putting a comma onto a policy which was already lying gathering dust on the table. They put a comma, they activate it, and they PR it to her. So I think they are, of course, with them, it's a lesson for a ruling party. It's a lesson for an ANC and EFF and all those, that you can't just speak and talk and all that. You must activate things, and you must communicate the activation of those things. So what they do well is they communicate, or what they do well is, first, they find low-hanging fruit. They say, what is the smallest thing that will make a big difference that we can activate now? And then how do we then communicate that well or massively so?
But the ANC can't even find the fruit tree, let alone the low-hanging fruit.
What I do want to ask about, because I do think that
I think Gareth is going to lose his citizenship after the show. I was just trying to figure it out.
This is just the way this show is.
It might be this one, Tebe.
Listen, Gareth, if we had the launch last night, I started worrying myself that, my goodness, am I going to lose my South African or my African citizenship? I'm probably going to be kicked out. I'm not sure I'm going to be invited into many other countries again. Because the truth of the matter is, this country, if there is a victory of this country in the last 30 years that perhaps an ANC has enabled, is things is what we are doing today. The freedom to be able to express ourselves. So if you speak about the continent earlier, not many countries, I can count on a hand, have this latitude that we have to criticize, to communicate ourselves. That is, to me, the most fundamental important things. And of course, what we want, what should complement this is also delivery on services. So if one so imagine this freedom to express yourself, the freedom to find an opportunities, but then you need a government to create an enabling environment for those opportunities to be realized. Imagine where we would be as a country. This is still, despite our challenges, the most beautiful country on the continent, one of the most inspiring countries in the continent. We have challenges, but we have to work on them. But we at least have the foundation to work on. We just need to get, whether it's a GNU, whether it's an ANC, whether it's whatever government we have running the country, we just need to get things done.
You know, speaking of opportunity, one of the things that often gets spoken about, not just of this country, but the continent as a whole, is the youth dividend.
70% of the continent is under the age of 30. South Africa would not be far behind that. And most of them are unemployed and frustrated and educated.
Is there opportunity to think with the way that the world is shifting and changing, the opening up of technologies and new ways, and even post the pandemic, new ways of plugging into the world of work where you don't have to be in the city where you work?
Well, this, you're talking about, but these digital nomads you're talking about who want to work wherever they are, from the bedroom, on top of Kilimanjaro or Table Mountain, lying on the beach in Camps Bay and working. It's fine, but can they create something?
What do you mean by
because,
that?
Because the challenge with South Africa, my country, is you saw the stats now. 45% are on SASSA. Mm. So that means about half the country is not working. And then that's just the SASSA ones. Then you look at the unemployed youth. And if the youth are the majority of the country, it gives you an idea that even the number is higher of people who are dependent on some kind of aid. Then if you look at the fact that only 7% pay tax, so 93% of South Africa depends on 7%. It gives you an idea that if there is a failure of the last 30 years, is to create a country where a Tebe, a Pumi, a Jack do not depend on a government, but create their own opportunity. So you're asking about these unemployed, educated, and frustrated youth. South Africa, because it's such a nanny state, should perhaps have failed the young people by making them believe that a government will deliver for them. Government should not be the place that the government should just create an enabling environment. But we should be out like the rest of the continental kids, hustling, creating, and instead of doing what we do in South Africa, what do? We like to consume. Ali Mazrui, may soul rest in peace, said, Africa, and it may be as South Africa, produces what it doesn't consume, and consume what it doesn't produce. And our young people are waiting for a government to do stuff for them. They are so good in technology, good all those. They should be creating digital products. We're living in the digital era. They should be saying how my ability, instead of going on social media and criticizing the rest of us, going on social media and calling us names and trolling and doing all those things, what they should be doing, they should be saying, how do we create products and services, digital products and services, which will contribute to a better society, but most importantly, which will alleviate the triple challenges of South Africa, which is poverty, inequality, and joblessness.
Do you see on your travels on the continent any other countries doing that better than us? You know, when I think about our education is teka-teking at best.
Teka-teking. Because when we were going to school, you had to get at least 50% to look like somebody intelligent. But now, all the ones born, I don't know when, 1994, they just have to get 30% and somebody tells them that you don't need 70% of the information. So if you've left 70% of the information behind, how on earth are you going to be a productive member of society? Because in essence, you don't know anything. So across the continent, I mean, I went to the University of Zimbabwe on a Saturday at 5 p.m. I saw kids in the library, in the cleanest library I have seen. Anyway, America, Europe or South Africa, in the cleanest, shiny library studying. And I got to understand why Zimbabwean kids operate on two levels in South Africa. They're either running the biggest companies in the country, or with their education, they have the humility to say, I'd become a waiter because I'm not going to wait for somebody to create an opportunity for me. So with my degree, because I can't find my job in my country or anywhere else, I become a waiter, I become a cleaner, and all those. Because the other challenge with South Africans is we are snobs. We are snobs. We say, I mean, shame, I'm not going to become a waiter. I'm not going to become a maid. I'm not going to be cleaning streets and all those type of things. Well, yeah, it's a job. And some of those jobs have created many of us. Because some of our parents, our families, our sisters and all those were maids, were gardeners, not necessarily all by choice, but how life happened. And they used that opportunity to create many of us who now look down on the very jobs which created us.
And I could not agree more.
You have extremely well-educated young people, but the country is not offering opportunity, not just Zimbabwe. I'm thinking about Nigeria on the side. I'm thinking about Kenya.
I mean, the suffered. Sorry, I didn't answer. I didn't finish answering the question. You're right. I think there's a sense of hopelessness across the continent and desperation across the continent. But there's also a sense of opportunity and hope. So, of course, the challenges in Nigeria, as we've seen now, with the economic challenges, with the naira, the rate of the naira, the devaluation of the naira, makes it very difficult for people. But let me tell you, the young people there still say, how do I hustle to put food on the table? Because they don't have a social securities that we have. They don't have the SASAs of the world. They don't have the free medical hospitals or affordable hospitals if you can't afford the medical aids. They don't have many of those social nets that we have here in South Africa. You go to Kenya and you find those kids creating. I mean, Nigeria and Kenya and Rwanda, they have positioned themselves as the digital hubs of the continent. I went to Somalia, to Mogadishu, and I went to an innovation hub. I was just amazed. I'm like, when we think of Mogadishu, we think of dodging bullets and dodging bombs.
Yes,
we do. And there were lots of those while I was there. But there was also this innovation hub I went to. And I looked at it and I said, if they could create a hub like this, then maybe there is opportunity for the rest of us. Maybe there's opportunity for the continent to reimagine itself. There are challenges in the continent. So let's not try and glorify the other countries or rather us talk down to a South Africa. That challenge is everywhere else. But what I like about the rest of the continent is, while there is desperation, but there is also the ability to say, what can I do for my family? Because I think it's Mother Teresa who says, do what you can with what you have, where you are. That's how we create a difference.
So sure. I want to ask a question about branding. Sorry, Pums. Because as a country, we can sit here all day, and South Africans do like to moan. We like to moan about what's wrong, how we could be better, and all of that's fine as long as you do want to get better and you have a plan to get better. And I want to ask you, as someone who's dealt with branding and with massive brands all your life, what are the things that we can trumpet to the world? Because I'm afraid, you know, talking about 1994 now feels like a very long time ago.
And it is. It's getting good.
There are countries much younger than us that have also beautiful stories to tell. And like no one's, and Mandela, obviously, I'm a child of that generation. This stuff means a lot to me sentimentally, but it's no longer a branding opportunity that it might have been, you know, 5 years into democracy, 10 years, even 20. Now we've got to find other things. And I remember the ANC had that, it was partially successful, that good story to tell chapter of their history. And I feel like we need to have another good story to tell. Where do you think the good bits are that we can start using to project a positive brand image of South Africa? And what things should we just avoid? Because we also have this really annoying habit of stepping into landmines and looking for attention in all the wrong places when we do, you know, the president making speeches at X, Y, or Z place and who he associates with. Like, what can we avoid and what can we improve and what can we trumpet to the world?
So from a branding perspective, let me look at it whether it's a branding of the country, whether it's a branding of the branding of brands. So we do, for the last 14 years, I do a study called Brand Africa 100, Africa Most Admired Brands. It's a pure research-based across the continent, 32 countries, who collectively represent about 85% of the GDP and 85% of the population of the continent. We have established over the last 15 years, including this year, that on average, only 20% of the brands that Africans admire are made in Africa.
Wow.
And from a South African perspective, it's about 33% of the brands that South Africans admire are made in South Africa. So you now see the challenge that we have. In South Africa, we have a 67%. You either call it a problem or an opportunity. But we have the potential. Because if you look at this country, we have a brand like MTN, which is 30 years old, and Vodacom, which are 30 years old this year. That shows you that those brands, that we have the ability to create brands which can make a difference. Because those two brands have enabled the continent to communicate, not just South Africa, the country, the continent, to communicate as well as to do commerce. So that's on just one end. You look at a brand like a MultiChoice or DSTV, which has enabled us, which created a platform to tell our stories into the rest of the world, into the rest of the continent. So just as an example, whether it's in the media space, whether it's technology space, and even when it's in the product space, we have a lot of great brands. But what I love mostly is the young brands, whether it is Makosa, whether it is Tepo Jeans, whether it is Tebe Magugu.
Whose T-shirt whether Garrett it is wearing today.
Right? Whether it is Tebe Magugu, that what I was wearing at my launch yesterday, because he's from South Africa. I mean, he's from Kimberley. I'm from Kimberley. His name Tebe. I'm Tebe. I thought it just makes sense. It's just one of those things. I think.
Did you also play Tebe?
I only met Tebe Lenyora for the first time in my whole life at the DSTV Delicious. We both know of each other's existence because I think there's only three Tebes in the country.
I will. That's not true, man.
No, I think so. I've never met others.
I've only
met Tebe the legend, Lenyora, and then Tebe the branding, and then Tebe the designer. All the other ones, we have not recognized yet. So we are the ones who give out the licenses on Tebeness.
Oh, okay.
But I think, Gareth, to your point is Tebe Magugu being the first LV prize winner globally, not African prize winner, not prize for Africa, global prize. That recognition gives an idea of what we're capable of. What we've done with our black coffee gives an idea of what we're capable of, mm-hmm. from the arts to design to products to technology. This country still has the foundation and is still the most inspirational reference point of how to create brands which make a difference. You know what? Black coffee, what Tebe Magugu, what Esther have done, they have given us the confidence to be ourselves. So, because it's from a heritage perspective, from a culture perspective, they're like, hey, it's cool to be yourself as a South African.
Mm.
And to name your brand Tebe Magugu or Tsepo Jeans. Mm. And to not feel that you have to find an English or a Latin or a French name just to be cool.
Mm.
Being African is cooler than anything else.
It is. Being African is cooler than anything else. But I do also wonder, South Africa still having the loudest voice on the continent.
Oh, that's what I've said. That's what I was focusing on that if you look at the most admired brands in the continent, I think half of them, half of the 20% I talked about are South African. Others are Nigeria and Kenya and Ethiopia with Ethiopian Airways. Mm-hmm. With Safaricom and Pesa from Kenya. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Dangote from Nigeria, and then South Africa with the MTNs and all those. So South Africa is the loud. That's why I say it's a reference point of excellence in brand building. So we will remain that for a while, but we are losing our cool as other countries catching up very fast. Nigeria in the fintech space is catching up very fast. Kenya. In the fintech space is obviously set the pace with M-Pesa, Nigeria following up. Rwanda as a country is now battling with Kenya for who is the tech lead in the country. Which country which can position itself as a tech hub for the continent? So that's where we are as a country. We just must not lose the sight of how great this country is.
So we spoke a little bit about BRICS. Earlier on, and you also alluded, speaking of Mogadishu, with the bombs and bullets, right? The continent still has a lot of internal strife. You know, we still have the highest number of armed conflicts on this continent, even though the world as a whole has got all of their own fights happening. And with BRICS, growing influence of Russia and their arms.
Well, you got Russia, you got Saudi Arabia, you got China. Egypt, you got China, you got baby South Africa, you got Brazil.
Yeah. Is the continent's instability a threat to the brand that we could export into the rest of the world, the instability of this continent?
I think what we need to learn from the continent, we need to learn from the Chinese and the Brazilians of the world, and even the Saudi Arabians of the world. Because in those countries, there's a separation of who they are from the problems that they have. Mm-hmm. So the problems that they have are not the brand that they are.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go to Brazil, they'll tell you in Brazil, you cannot go to that area because that area is dangerous. They will kidnap you, the favelas and all those type of places. But their global brand is about this beautiful place of salsa, their amazing Christ the Redeemer, this football stars. So they promote their positives ahead of everything else. Similarly, America, everybody knows that Trump is not the reference point on global leadership, but it doesn't take away from the fact that when we think about America, we don't think about Trump.
Mm.
We think about Facebook, we think about Instagram. Well,
But most Africans, if you saw the survey that they did, I think it was just 3 or 4 months ago, they asked exactly that question, like, who is the most American? And Trump came out head and shoulders above everyone else in America. Obama.
Because if you go to deep America, you will understand that Trump is not an anomaly. Trump is exactly who America is.
I'm talking about what Africans say about him. I'm not saying what America. We're about to have another Trump era, so we better start redefining. Well, we better start redefining what exactly leadership is, because if the snake keeps rearing its head and you don't know how to deal with it, you've got to kind of change your approach.
I think we need to separate one. We need to separate the country from the person. What America has done has created incredible institutional resilience, and has created a strong sense of global identity as we American, how they speak, which is separate from the leaders who come and go every 4 to 8 years. Mm-hmm. So what we fail to do in the continent is our challenge. Not only are we not great at telling our story, but we are even poorer at creating resilient institutions which exist beyond the individuals.
Mm-hmm.
So to me, that is the main difference.
Well, the individuals don't leave.
Well, the Queen was in power for 50 years and nobody complained.
Listen, but she also had a whole other government that changed every now and again, and we know right, the problem there.
I'm being facetious, but I think, of course, I'm being facetious. But let's address the tenure. Paul Kagame has been in power since 94 and will be until 37 or so. It is not the tenure. It is the impact of the leader, the contribution to the country. So he has been in power, but what has he created for Rwanda, which is the 12, 15 million people? He's created a sense of peace. Rwandans don't describe themselves by tribe. They describe themselves countrywide. They say, we are Rwandans. We are not Hutus and Tutsis. We are Rwandans. So creative of identity. Third, he has created a sense of opportunity because it is one of the fastest growing economies. Doesn't matter from what base, but it's the fastest growing economy. Everything is relative in the world. the fastest growing economy in Africa, a great place to do business. I think you can get your license in seven days. So I don't think the tenure is so much the issue. The issue is, if you're going to be in power...
Are you taking over Tito's job? No, but I'm just... being the Rwandan...
Is Tito... No, but I'm just
Tito Mboweni was a fan.
No, but I'm saying that if you're going to be in power for 30 years, do it like Rwanda. If you're going to be in power for 30 years, do not do it like the others, whether it's Cameroon, whether it's, are you with me? Where the guy is 91 years old and is running again for president. You know your grandfather at 70 can't even think straight. And now here you got a 91-year-old who claims that he's going to be able to run the country. Having said that, spending half of his life every year in Geneva or in Switzerland or somewhere in Geneva, or in Switzerland, I think it's Geneva, okay? Or Paris. So I'm just saying tenure is not the barometer of excellent leadership or impact is what we should be measuring.
Sorry.
Thank you. I hope I've answered that question for you. Because what we want, I think Barack Obama said at, maybe he said it at Mandela's funeral or memorial, that what Africa needs is not strong men, but men with strong ideas. And having a strong idea is what we want from our leaders. It's also what Salif Ellen Johnson said, that Africa is not poor. It is just poorly led. So we just need leadership to do what leadership does, to lead, to be, as Napoleon Bonaparte said, the dealer in hope.
I like all of that, but what do you think of our current crop of leaders? Because I do agree with you that we need institutional resilience. We need to have a country which has a succession plan for the country, regardless of who the man or woman at the top is. But I think we've got a really, really piss-poor crop at the moment. I mean, Pumi agrees with me on this. I'm not going to have any argument from her. But our current leadership are about as spineless and jellyfish as it's possible for leaders to be, which is why the GNU suits all of them, right? Because you can apportion blame all over the place, and you obfuscate. You can take credit for things that you didn't do. There's a lot that we can just make gray rather than black and white. And I feel like our leaders are wanting. There's maybe we've got unrealistic expectations of what we want a leader to be. But you've just said something that appeals to many South Africans, is that these people need to step up and be men with strong ideas. I don't see any of those guys in politics in South Africa. I see some of them in business. I see some of them in society. I see people making a difference at a more local level, but I don't see this in our leaders.
Those positions of leadership aren't interesting to young people enough to step in there. They would rather be hustling rather than
hustling into the position. Hustling is the leadership position as well. So I think the mistake that we do in South Africa is to delegate or relegate the responsibility of leadership to politicians. I think anybody can lead wherever they are, and whether you lead from a business, whether you lead from a foundation, whatever it is, from community leadership or from church leadership, it's how. So what we need to do, we need to create cells of leadership and inspire leadership everywhere where we are. Then South Africa will be great again. But of course, the second thing is we need to hold all those leaders, whether it is in church, and you know, South Africa is like now a breeding field for all these charismatic churches, which all they do is actually, is it cash or charismatic? I always get confused. Churches, so there needs to be accountability. So society must hold leaders accountable, citizens must hold leaders accountable, and those leaders are not just in government. And I think if you look at the recent results in South Africa, it shows you a sense of South Africa maturation and South Africa holding leaders accountable. So the GNU is just a reflection of a growing the populace that says, a populace who's growing maturity in holding those who are in power to account. I think that's how we look at it. And I think there is no bad leader. There are just bad citizens, because the citizens are the ones who put those people in power. So we cannot, you know, FT Magazine had a review on Donald Trump's first time, when he was in power first time. Mm. And they said, this man campaigned on anti-immigration, fossil fuels, and a whole range of other stuff that looks anti the rest of the world and pro-America. And they say we cannot at this stage criticize him for being bad because Americans voted for him and he is delivering to America what he was voted on. So that's accountability. The fact that he was kicked out is an accountability. We happened here as well. It showed itself here in South Africa. And I think whether you were you mentioning about the other parties and the other ruling parties and all those comparing performance and all those, I think doesn't matter whether how ADA, for example, claims credit for expediency and activation or somebody else claiming or looking at others and say that others are lacking or lagging. At the end of the day, when those ministers do well, whether they're ANC or DA, South Africa does well. So there's now the GNU has got a beautiful internal mechanism to hold each other accountable. Because if I'm a minister in other portfolio, I would not want to be outshined by another minister in other portfolio. Because what is the DA doing? The DA is creating an argument, creating a proof of concept for the next elections for themselves. I don't think the ANC is going to just allow it to happen that way. It will also raise the level of performance in the ANC, in the PA, in anybody else who has ID, delivers ID. Raise the level of performance for everybody else. And South Africa will be doing better. That's what we want. We really don't care who's doing this. We just care that South Africa is doing well.
Don't care. They don't care at them. They're not even trying. They're not even trying. But somebody in the comments asked if you were to say in 10 words or less, if you were to, and I remember I know you are, Baba. There was a time when we had a slogan for the country, Alive with Possibilities. What would you say South Africa is now?
To me, and I was on the board of Brand South Africa for 3 years. And then I've been on the advisory part of Brand South Africa as well for 3 years. I've been as well. And I've always said to them, to my team, my colleagues there and my clients there, Alive with Possibility was possibly the strongest statement of the country. And that, that statement should have stayed. I think it's because I think we are still alive for the possibilities. We're still alive for the possibilities of creating the South Africa we imagined. We're still alive for possibilities to be able to lift, to reduce inequality, poverty, and create jobs. So South Africa remains alive with possibility. What we want to ensure that we have a country that creates an enabling, or a government that creates an enabling environment for that opportunity, or that possibility to come alive.
Well, Yvonne Johnson and her team, Mike Shalit and his team, can take a bow if you still think that we are still alive with
possibility. I still think so. I mean, I'm not looking at it even as an individual thing. I mean, the new slogan for the last 10 or so years is what inspiring new ways. Of course, we still inspire because we're still, as I said, we're still an inspirational reference point in the continent. But I think equally so, we are alive with possibilities.
So
I like Kazakhstan's one. It is nice.
Well, you have to pick
it. Azerbaijan also has a great one.
Well, I mean, you know how the Gen Z says, they say you have to pick a struggle. You can't be poor and ugly. So all these taglines are just a struggle that you pick. We've picked possibility and inspiration. They've picked nice.
Tara, I love you so much, and thank you for all your wisdom and insights today. And for people who are, you know, the one other thing you talk about in the book, you mentioned Jay Naidoo saying that Africa doesn't have an agenda for itself. Everybody else has an agenda.
For Africa.
For Africa. What do you think Africa's, as a parting shot, what do you think South Africa's agenda for itself should be? And what should Africa's agenda be?
Well, I think South Africa as a country, we still need to refine who we are and what we stand for. Once we do that and get everybody fighting for that, and we don't have that yet. You know, that's why I spoke about an American who says, we are Americans. They don't even have to define it, what Americans mean. Mm. But we know when they mean they're entrepreneurial, they mean they're resilient, and they see themselves as the protector of the of democratic
world ideas. Police.
World police. We need to define clearly, articulately, and it must resonate with the rest of South Africans, who we are and what we stand for. I mean, that's what I try to. Mm-hmm. In many ways, I didn't. This is not a travelogue, as you've noticed. So people say to me, "Oh my God, can't wait to get into this book and look, go travel with you through other continent." Well, there's no map here. No, what you're gonna find here, yeah? You're gonna find my reflections on the challenges and opportunities of the continent through my eyes, having been in the countries. And what you're going to find here is the opportunity and the potential that lies on those kids like myself who grew up in the three bedrooms. Some of them grew up on the trees in the townships and have come to a big place like Johannesburg and has not been overwhelmed by this, but have continued their journeys, not just into here, and not just beyond their borders, but the journeys of themselves, because all of us are on a journey. And this book speaks to that all of us are on some kind of journey. And your journey may be to become a great broadcaster. Your journey may be to change the world. Your journey may be literally to go from country to country. All of us are travelers.
Sure. What a way to end it all.
Beautiful.
But everybody must buy the book for a good reason. I hope they can find it. It is number one in Rosebank, number one in Nicol Way, number one in Morningside, number one everywhere else. It's the number one. It's the fastest number one at Exclusive Book. The publishers were saying they were incredibly, they said it's unprecedented. They didn't expect that. There was a great sense of anticipation yesterday with over 500 people at the launch. Exclusive said they've never seen a book launch like that. And they say they don't think they'll ever see one like that. And I agree with them.
And buying the book is not going to make Tebe rich, guys.
Unfortunately.
Buying the book, however, is going to contribute to a scholarship fund that Mr. Dr. Tebe Ikalofeng has started. Do you want to tell us a little bit about
that? I'm glad you said that, Pumi, because it's also quite important that we need to pay it forward as people in quote-unquote privileged positions. And part of writing this book was not to write a bestseller book so that I can become wealthy or famous or any of those things. Those have never been my ideals in life. My ideal in life has always been, how can I leave this place better than I found it? And creating to a better country and continent than I found it is by lifting others as you rise. Is by and the scholarship program is for people to resolve the one big problem that I'm familiar with, that I have an insight into, which is the creation of Made in Africa brands. And I said 20%, only 20% of the brands that we admire in the continent are African. Well, I need to solve the 80% problem. And part of solving the 80% problem is to create the talent and to inspire the talent that will create those brands.
Love it. Love it.
Thank you, everybody. This has been The Burning Platform right here on the podcast party. Like and subscribe and all the rest. Now, before Tebe gets angry with me, the reason I wasn't at his book launch last night is because we had our own incredible panel discussion at the podcast party, which, if you missed it...
It couldn't have been less more incredible at our launch. It's just an FYI. Well,
this is what happens with men.
I was very entertained. I watched Penwell, the Black Pen, interview and ask questions of a panel that comprised of the ATM, the DA, and the PAC. Could you wish for a more unlikely combination? All three of the guests on the panel were on fire. There were some very, very funny moments. There were some very, very true things said. Bra Eddie from the PAC was absolutely devastating. And if you want to watch that, you can go and check it out later today on the podcast party. But like and subscribe and set a little reminder for yourself so that you don't miss anything. We will see you for the Burning Platform. What?
Turn on your notifications.
Thank 4 you
p.m.
I'm going to look at that. I will say that those who were on your panel, their chairmen were at my launch. So... Herman Mashaba at my launch, chairman of organization. So it's just a matter of who you wanted to have here, Gareth. You could have chosen to be at the right place.
The show is over.
That's why it's called a burning platform. They didn't say it's a quiet platform.
I'll tell you what. You had me excited and interested, and I was feeling a little bit of FOMO until you mentioned Herman Mashaba, and then I was like, nah, actually, I chose right. Okay, thanks, everybody. I will see you next
week. Thank you. Cheers. All the best. Thank you.